Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Founders Grid sponsored by Gaper.io. Today we have Richard. Richard is the president at Culture Tech. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mustafa. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, brief background about yourself, you know, prior to what you were doing before Culture Tech, what led you to form Culture Tech, and then we'll discuss later on how Culture Tech is doing.
Right. Yeah, my career has been primarily in the marketing services space, working with small companies, mid-size, large enterprise. And in the last few years, for me, what became very interesting is the conversations we were having with a lot of our global clients about two things, really. One, their digital strategies. And then increasingly, how they're managing content. Everybody obviously is in the content business today, regardless what sector you're in. And what started to, frankly, intrigue me and get me kind of inspired is seeing all of the various companies that allow all of us, to technology companies, to manage, distribute, develop content in more efficient and effective, increasingly efficient, you know, cost-efficient ways. So I started to just research a number of in a number of areas and discovered that in the art space, there's a significant opportunity to help those that own have intellectual property rights to art to better manage the process of those rights. So what's interesting is most people don't realize, I didn't realize that if you own an object of art, that does not necessarily mean you own the rights to a reproduction of it. And folks in the art world all know this, in specific museums, art galleries, collectors, auction houses, publishing companies who all have to communicate around, utilize images of art, of objects of art. The process is unfortunately very difficult. It is old fashioned tools, email, faxes, things that can be automated, and a workflow that can be automated. So we started Culture Tech precisely for that reason. And in the process, what we've discovered in working with our beta trial customers, most of whom are museums, some of them are artist foundations, is that there's an equally powerful opportunity to connect data that for the most part is siloed. So allowing those that have collections to connect to other collections is also a big data opportunity. So our business is really, we defined it as workflow automation, and then big data connection as a consequence of that.
Okay.
So that's a little bit about me and how we got into it.
No, that's interesting, amazing. You know, it is actually a piece of information for me. I'm not a big collector, but I do feel like that I'm a small collector, and it was kind of like, mind opening for me. I was like, So, before we discuss the early years and the early adoption, how is that like? I would, because what happens is, this is kind of like mind opening for me. Then, there are people that have holdings in like multiples of millions of dollars and stuff, right? So did you build the software first, or you talked about the problem first and, how you went about it?
So what we did is we went out and talked to those that manage IP rights every day. And where that leads you is to the 55,000 or so museums in the US and then around the world who either manage daily requests for the rights to an image or a much more difficult and challenging task is exhibition management. So every time you see a book publication or an ad with a piece of art or a picture of a piece of art in a publication, every one of those instances requires a workflow to license. So the way we started is a lot of qualitative research that led to then an MVP of a software product with about 60 organizations, mostly in the US. And that brought us to really be able to define market fit, understand the customer and the buying process for this type of software, and to also develop relationships. That was a big part of it. Develop trusted relationships with organizations that really need what we're building. And so then we set about to build with them an initial release of a workflow automation tool. One of the things that you may know, and I did a lot of homework on, is a lot of startups fail because they don't work. They don't develop the product with the customer. And we were very methodical about that in actually developing those relationships and using a really talented group of people across museums in the technology technology aspect of a museum, technology groups, CTOs and chief digital officers, as well as those licensing managers in those institutions. And the product we've designed is really with them. And then, we will scale from there because there is a network effect. Most of these organizations all communicate, all of them, with each other. You can't live in the ecosystem of the art world without really that connection. And that connection, for the most part, in this area, licensing, isn't automated. So that's the work we did to understand the opportunity and solve the problem, and the trust I think we were able to build to gain adoption.
Wow, interesting, And how was the COVID times for you folks? Because that was kind of like an interesting time when museums, viewings, everything was closed, and everyone was kind of like exploring taking things virtual. So was it kind of like a catalyst for you, or
we started our company before COVID. We're a distributed team of people in North America. We have developers we're in partnership with a development company in Ireland and Romania. So for us, we were distributed. We were working already pre-COVID that way. But what was really interesting is I think two things happened in the customer community, our potential customer community. One, yes, as you say, Mustafa, you had people who were, like in every sector, were moving from an office to a homework environment. And in the case of museums in particular, the buildings are closed and they're very reliant on a physical space and a physical commerce, really. So it did two things. One, I think it allowed us to have a dialogue with people who were, a lot of whom were working from home. They're still connected within their industry through communities that they're in and conferences that they go to online and so forth. But what I think happened is the recognition that you have the need for greater digital access to assets, easier ability to gain permissions digitally, to grant permissions digitally. It brought into focus, really, the need for the kind of workflow automation that we're doing. And I think that's true across a lot of industries during COVID, where we all need easier, more efficient ways of working that technology provides, right? And so I just went from this I got on this call having hung up from a Slack call, and we, you know, like a lot of small and big companies, we operate in a Slack environment, sometimes in a Microsoft Teams environment, in a Google environment, where all of those tools make work very, very efficient, as you well know, in being in the software development business. So all of that during COVID did nothing but accelerate make easier what we were doing.
Got it. So NFTs, art NFTs, it's been, everyone has been talking about, a lot of work is being done around it, and you know, we're kind of seeing all kinds of art coming out of it. You know, now they're like intelligent NFTs coming, you know, AI powered NFTs coming, all kind of things, stuff coming, right? Your thoughts, anything about it? NFT?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I love, our lead developer loves to say NFTs don't yet know what they want to be when they grow up. You know, I think that's really very true. Like so many new developments, especially technology developments, there's always a gold rush first before things settle down. I think some of us remember the dot-com bubble in the late 90s. A lot of people don't know in the late 1920s and 30s, there were hundreds of automobile companies in the United States and way more around the world. And then, of course, there's the gold rush itself, right, in the 1880s and 1890s. So right now, there's a lot of attention being paid to embedding NFTs, as you mentioned, in art objects, things like fractional ownership of art. At CultureTech, we actually wrote a paper on blockchain 4 or 5 years ago when we started this, because obviously, like many people, we saw the value of managing ownership rights on a blockchain. And by the way, I'm happy to, as a plug, happy to share that white paper with any of your listeners. So like a lot of people, we're excited about blockchain in art. But for us, I would say, perhaps more in practical ways, like tracking data, resolving ownership issues, ownership disputes, things that are a little bit less sexy, but still very important needs that need to be met. So the idea, obviously, of non-fungible tokens as a data tracking device has a very, very powerful future in the art world for sure.
Got it. So my last question, two questions, because you know, these podcasts, we keep them 12 to 15 minutes. So three pieces.
Oh, I'm losing you on volume on Mustafa.
Okay. Sorry, is it better now?
Yeah, you're good.
So my last two questions are primarily around, one is in regards to your advice to other founders, you know, that what piece of advice would you give to young founders? Like you mentioned, one of the advice was that many founders are unable to talk to their customers. You know, what other two pieces of advice you would like to give to youngsters or younger founders, you know, what to pursue and follow, right? So
I guess the first piece of advice I would give is working fast is not necessarily better. By that, I mean, we all get excited about a business opportunity. We all know that software, especially now, has a development process that's very well articulated and well developed. And because of cloud-based computing, there's a great deal of efficiency, as we spoke about earlier. But what we found, back to the earlier point I made, is that really understanding how a customer, in this case, a business customer, behaves, not just from a professional workflow point of view, but from a emotional sort of psychic point of view. What kind of environment are they working in? What kind of level of trust needs to be established? Things like this, which takes time. And so I would say that to me, we all have to be in a hurry. That's important. We all have to have a sense of urgency. That's critical in business. But I think actually taking the time to be thoughtful about development process, be very thoughtful about how your customer is going to adopt your product. We went through many, many iterations of MVP before we even built something. And then when we started to build something, we went through many, many sprints with customers before we ever, built back end and of functionality. So we took our time to be purposeful, but at the end to really ensure that we have a product that people love, people want to use. It's interesting that one of the things about a workplace tool is that it can be fun, and especially when the way it's being done now is very manual and very cumbersome, and fighting your way through email and files and remembering people's names and all the stuff that you, I'm sure, Apier is very involved in developing software that solves some of those problems for customers. But there has to be a sense of delight in using the product. And again, that takes effort with, I think, customers to design and build. For me, the second real piece of advice is all about building confidence in a team. And I feel fortunate because I came from a career of managing teams, everywhere, small teams, in my own office to big global teams distributed around the world. And that process of really understanding what motivates people in their job, how do they interact with each other? And that is, of course, where the remote workplace, which I'm happy to talk a little bit more about if you want to, made very difficult, right? I think especially, by the way, for younger people in starting their careers, really need to be in an office for at least some of the time to really be mentored, to be, to have to build relationships. There's also that whole reality of moving to a new city or a new country and your work friends become your network. And that's very, very difficult when, you're not working in a physical space. So building that trust, building those relationships, building that sense of teamwork is in some ways much more difficult than the environment we're living in. But it is, so therefore, in some ways, is even more important to focus on, to plan around, to use a lot of the tools we have at our disposal, to really make the process of working together fun and make people accountable at the same time. So
yeah, true. Last question, your own personal productivity hacks, so as a founder you have your highs and lows on a different days, right? So but the founder, you're supposed to be motivated every day, you have to hit the ground running, because founders are a different breed, from the corporate world. So in order to manage all of that, what are your own personal productivity hacks that keep you going?
Well, the first one is never give up on the vision, which, sounds obvious, but I think when you, I'm fortunate also because I came from an industry which requires entrepreneurial skill internally. In the marketing business, you don't survive unless you identify marketing opportunities, find new clients, build relationships with them. So for me, the whole idea of keeping your eye and your focus on that passion. And then the second hack is a really simple one. But I make lists constantly, and those lists are segmented into a variety of segments. But one is about people, one is about connecting with people, another is about goals. We're very rigorous at our company about weekly goals, monthly goals, quarterly goals, annual goals. All of that has to be written down. And also has to be, we have to remind ourselves of it on a daily basis. That's a big hack for me. And then maybe a third one is to spend a lot of time talking to people who are doing different things from what you're doing, but with whom you can identify and just share with. So it's funny, coming from the corporate environment, I did find it initially, I found my own reluctance in, well, maybe I shouldn't talk to that person because what we're doing is competitive, or I don't want to reveal too much, or I don't want to let them know that we don't know what we're doing. You know, and what I've discovered is I carve out at least 20 to 25% of my time on a monthly basis to spend time talking to people like you, frankly, yeah. And learning. And that has never failed me, we can too often get myopic. As much as as I said earlier, we need to focus. You also need to get away from your focus from time to time to learn and be open to thinking in new ways. And I've learned more, frankly, from other startup leaders in maybe doing different things, because we share some of the same obstacles, as you alluded to, some of the same challenges, and hearing that other people have those challenges is reassuring enough. And then hearing how they overcome them is super helpful. So those are a few of my hacks, if you want to call them that.
No, that was pretty insightful, you know. Thank you so much for this. We would love to have you on our longer podcast, because these ones, we try to keep them short and crisp because this is how they're designed. But we would love to definitely have you on our webinars, which are longer panel discussion. You know, it was really enjoy talking to you. It was a pleasure having you. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Let's talk again.
Let's talk again. Thanks,
Gordon. Bye-bye.